Presenting radio's foremost laboratory of new writing and production techniques, the Columbia Workshop. The Columbia Workshop presents Irwin Shaw's story, Act of Faith, as adapted by Charles S. Monroe and produced and directed by John Dietz. Act of Faith.
I'm redeployable, it's so enjoyable. I'm redeployable, it's so enjoyable.
The war had come. In time, they had joined up. They had fought to the end, somewhere in Germany. Now here they were, still in France, in the mud and the rain and the cheerless countryside.
I'm redeployable, it's so enjoyable. Hey, there's the CO's tent up ahead, Seeger.
So it is, Olsen, so it is.
Present the case to them in a pitiful light. Three battle-scarred veterans who fought their way from Omaha Beach to... What was the name of that town we fought our way to?
Königstein.
Königstein. Point out that we are the backbone of the Army, the non-commissioned officer. It's the captain's duty to see that you and Welch and myself get to Paris tonight. Mention our low state of mind, our lack of points, our need to have our morale improved.
Despite your song, you're so redeployable.
Well, the sentiment's untrue, but I like the tune. I'm redeployable. Mention our need for Paris and La Vie. Mention our decorations in passing.
What decoration shall I mention? The marksman's medal?
Never quite made it. I had a cross-eyed scorer. But mention the bronze star, the silver star, the Croix de Guerre with palms, the unit citation, the Congressional Medal of Honor.
You don't think that Captain Taney will remember we haven't won most of them, do you?
Do you suggest, sir, that one Southern military gentleman will dare doubt the word of another Southern military gentleman in the hour of victory?
Captain Taney and I come from Ohio.
Welch comes from Kansas. You've heard of Kansas? Magnolia-scented Kansas?
Of course. I'm no fool.
Here's his tent, Seeker.
Mm-hmm.
Do your duty by your men. Highest-ranking non-com present took the initiative and saved his comrades for a trip to Paris at great personal risk above and beyond the call of you-know-what.
I'll throw myself into the breach, Olsen.
Then be brave. Welch and I'll be waiting for you in our tent.
Okay.
Hello, Sergeant.
Hello, Sergeant.
The captain's writing a letter.
Oh, I can wait.
What's that there? Oh, hello, Seeger. Come on in.
Thank you, sir.
What's on your mind?
Am I disturbing you, sir?
Oh, no, no. Just writing a letter to my wife. You married, Seeger?
No, sir.
It's very difficult. My wife complains I don't love her enough. Been married 15 years. I think she'd know by now. I thought you and Welch and Olsen were going to Paris.
Oh, that's what I came to see you about, sir.
Oh, I suppose something's wrong with the passes.
It isn't the passes, sir. They're fine. They start tomorrow. It's just that, well...
Is this confidential?
If you don't mind, sir.
Johnny, go stand in the rain someplace.
Yes, sir.
Well, what is it, Seeger? Let's have it.
It's... Well, it's hard to say, sir, but it's money.
Oh, money. I know.
We haven't been paid for 3 months, sir.
I know. I'd like to take every lousy chair-warming old lady in the finance department and wring their necks.
You call for me, Captain?
No, get out of here, Johnny. Well, I suppose finance has its problems, too, Seeger. Outfits being broken up, being moved all over. Pretty rugged.
It wouldn't be so bad, sir, but going to Paris as we are, Olsen, Welch, and myself, we need... Well, you do need money in Paris.
Oh, I know. You know what I paid for a bottle of champagne there last September?
No, sir.
I won't tell you. You wouldn't have any respect for me the rest of your life.
Oh, Captain, the truth is I've come to borrow some money for Welch, Olsen, and myself. And we'll pay it back out of the first pay we get. But just say one word, sir, and I'll blow.
Stay where you are, son.
Yes, sir.
You like this wallet or sell again? Now, wait here to me. See, 20, 40, 60, 80, $50, 400 francs, Seeger. $8.
Oh, excuse me, sir. I shouldn't have asked.
Delighted, absolutely delighted to give you half. The truth is, most of my money goes home in allotments.
Oh, please, sir, don't divide it for our benefit.
And the truth is, I lost 1,100 francs in a poker game 3 nights ago. I ought to be ashamed of myself. Here you are, son. 200 francs.
Oh, no, sir, I can't take it.
Take it. That's a direct order.
Yes, sir. Sometimes, sir, when we get out, you have to come over to my house, and you and my father and my brother and I will go out on a real tear.
I regard that as a solemn commitment.
That's fine, sir.
Your brother's out of the hospital now?
Yes, sir. He's back living with my father at the university.
He's all right, your brother?
Yes, sir. So my father writes.
Good, good. I look forward to joining you for that celebration. And have a drink for me in Paris. A small one.
Yes, Captain. And thank you, sir.
Well, Seeger, mon vieux.
How much, Norman?
200 francs, gentlemen.
200 francs? A boy on a man's errand. I can see us painting Montmartre red on 200 francs. Bring on the dancing girls. Bring on the champagne. $4 worth.
Why, that miserable penny pinch.
Welch, the captain only had 400.
I revise my opinion.
I'm sorry.
Oh, skip it, skip it. I'm not worried.
He isn't worried.
I know where we can put our hands on 65 bucks.
Huh? Welch, my friend, I'll kill you if you're kidding.
What's this about $65, Welch?
Well, I got to talking with an Air Force captain. A little fat old paddle-footed captain who never got hired in the second floor at COMC headquarters. And he told me that what he would admire to do more than anything else is to take home a nice, shiny German Luger pistol to show to the boys back in Pacific Grove, California.
I see.
That Luger means a lot to Seeger Welch. A whole lot.
Oh, I was there when he got it. But they've been selling for as low as 35.
Yeah, I know. A lieutenant offered me 100 for it back in August.
You know, I'll bet you could sell yours to this captain for 65 and later on maybe buy another just as good for 35. That'd give you 30 clear on the deal.
The money would do a lot for our trip to Paris, wouldn't it?
Well, there's no hurry. I told the captain I'd see him about 8 tonight. That's 5 hours. You got plenty of time to make up your mind, Seeger.
Me, I'm not saying a word, Seeger.
Oh, I forgot. I picked up a letter for you, Norman.
Well, thanks.
That's your father's handwriting?
Yeah.
I saw the name and address, but it doesn't look like his other letters. He always writes so well, so neat, like a college professor should.
Yeah.
Read your letter, Seeger. I'm just going to lie here and think about that nice Air Force captain.
Well, I'll think about him some more after I read this.
Dear Norman, sometime in the future, you must forgive me for writing this letter. But I have been holding this in so long, and there is no one here to talk to. Because of your brother's condition, I must pretend to be cheerful and optimistic all the time at home, both with him and your mother, who has never been the same since Leonard was killed. Norman, I need help. While the war was on and you were fighting, I kept this to myself. It wouldn't have been fair to burden you. But now the war is over, and I no longer feel I can stand up under this alone. And you will have to face it sometime when you get home, if you haven't faced it already. And perhaps we can help each other by facing it together.
So what? If we don't get the 65 bucks, we can always go to the Louvre. I understand the Mona Lisa is back.
Is it free, Olsen?
Sure, it's free. Did you ever hear of the Pantheon, Welch?
No.
It's free, too.
I'll go. What else is there in Paris that doesn't cost anything?
It wasn't until last Sunday morning that something happened to make me feel its full force. I don't know how much you guessed about the reason for Jacob's discharge from the army. It's true, he was pretty badly wounded in the leg at Metz. But I've asked around, and I know that men with worse wounds are returned to duty after hospitalization. Jacob is suffering now from what I suppose you call combat fatigue. And he is subject to fits of depression and hallucinations. Your mother and I thought that as time went by and the war in the army receded, he would grow better. Instead, Norman, he is growing worse. Last Sunday morning, when I came down into the living room, he was crouched in his old uniform next to the window, peering out. Jacob. Jacob, what's wrong?
I'm observing, Father. V1s and V2s. Buzz bombs and rockets. They're coming. By the hundreds.
No, Jacob. You're here at home in Ohio with your mother and me.
Get down, Father. Get down. You'll be killed by the flying glass.
Jacob, can't you see? You're home. You're safe. Look over there. The towers of the universe.
Get down. You'll be cut to bits.
Very well. I'll get down.
Lower, lower. Get down lower, Father. You'll be killed.
Jacob, we're safe in America. We're thousands of miles from the nearest spot where bombs fell. Jacob, this is America.
You don't understand. These are the new rocket bombs. The new rocket bombs for the Jews.
He got for winning the Bronze Star and threw it in the fireplace. And then he got down on his hands and knees and picked it out of the ashes and made me pin it on him again. And he kept repeating, "This is when they're coming for the Jews. This is when they're coming for the Jews."
Welch, where'd Seeger go?
Huh? Hey, he was here a minute ago.
I just closed my eyes a second.
There he is. Walking toward that field over there.
There's his raincoat on his bed. That fool will get wet and get a cold, and Paris has nothing to see with a cold
it
in your...
Stop raining, Olsen. Norman must be worried about something just to walk off without saying anything.
You gave him enough to worry about. You and that Air Force captain and $65 for the Luger.
Well, we told him to think it over.
That German SS major nicked Seeger's helmet with two shots before Seeger got him.
I know. I told him to think it over.
Look. He's standing out in that field reading that letter from his father.
Terrible thing, Norman, is that I find myself coming to believe sometimes that it is Jacob who is the normal one. And I, going about my business, teaching economics in a quiet classroom, pretending that the world is comprehensible and orderly, am really the mad one. I ask you once more to forgive me for writing you a letter like this. But it is crowding me, too. I do not see rockets and bombs, but I see other things. Wherever you go these days, restaurants, hotels, clubs, trains, you seem to hear talk. Mean, hateful, murderous talk. Each day the news is filled with stories of Jews still being killed somewhere on the globe. And there are columnists who each day grow more and more outspoken and popular. On VJ Day, in celebration, hoodlums in Los Angeles savagely beat a Jewish writer. It's difficult to know what to do, where to look for friends. To 3 months ago, I stopped my Thursday night poker game after playing with the same men for 10 years. John Riley happened to make a remark. Maybe he didn't mean it. Probably he didn't think. But when I asked an apology, he refused. And when I looked at the faces of the men who had been my friends for so long, I saw they were not with me. When I left the house, no one said goodnight. I knew the poison was spreading from Germany before the war and during it, but I had not realized it had come so close. Most hateful of all, I found myself looking for Jewish names on the casualty lists and secretly being glad when I found them there, to prove that there, at least, among the dead and wounded, we belonged. 3 times, thanks to you and Jacob and Leonard, I found our name there. And God forgive me, at the expense of your blood and your brother's life, through my tears, I felt the same twinge of satisfaction. Are we asking too much and asking the right to live? When I hear about Jews still being killed in Poland, or Jews requested that they be given back their homes in France, or that they be allowed to enter some country where they will not be murdered, I find myself unreasonably annoyed with them. I feel that they are boring the rest of the world with their problems, that they are making demands upon the world by being killed, by being hungry, by asking for the return of their property. This is how I feel today, son. I need some help. You've been to war. You've fought and killed men who tried to kill you. You've seen the people of other countries. Maybe you understand things that I don't understand. Maybe you see some hope somewhere. Help me. Your loving father.
They're for the Jews.
Wherever you go these days, restaurants, hotels, clubs, trains, you seem to hear talk. Mean, hateful, murderous talk. And when I looked around at the faces of the men who had been my friends for so long, I could see they were not with me.
Now, how you must think about it. No use being angry with your father for making it necessary to think about it. While you were fighting, you were too busy, frightened, weary to think. The rest of the time, you relaxed. You put your brain on the shelf, postponing everything to that impossible time for solving everything after the war. After the war. After the war. You must think now, Seeger. You must think.
Now the war is over, and I no longer feel I can stand up under this alone. And you will have to face it when you get home.
What was it like before, back home? 3 years is so long. So long. You knew then that there were all sorts of Jews. Some who saw signs against the Jew in every smile on a streetcar, every whisper. Pogroms in every newspaper article. Scorn in every handshake. Death behind each closed door. But you weren't like that. You were young and big and healthy, easygoing. Back in America, what was going on in Europe was remote, unreal. The chanting bearded men burning in furnaces. The dark-eyed women screaming prayers in Polish and Russian and German as they were pushed naked into gas chambers were as shadowy and unreal to you as they were to the men who went through the plays with you in the giant stadium. The men named O'Dwyer and Wickersham and Poole. But these tortured people seem more related to you in Europe.
When you went through the towns taken back from the Germans, gaunt, gray-faced men and women stopped you on the streets humbly. Unbelieving, they peered at you and whispered,
"Are you a Jew?"
You hadn't thought of yourself much that way. You were an American. You never quite understood why they asked it until one day in Strasbourg.
"And you? You are a Jew?"
"Yes."
"You hear? You hear, Martha?"
"It is not true. It cannot be true."
"He is not lying, Martha. Why should this young American soldier lie?"
"He is so big, so strong. He walks with the others. A Jew?"
May I feel your arm, soldier?"
Why, yes. Go ahead."
"So strong, so healthy. And your rifle, soldier. It is a beautiful rifle."
It's an M1. Here, would you like to look at it? It's like the ones the others carry."
"Like the others carry?"
"Hmm.
A Jew marching beside the others to liberate us? Did I have lived to see this?"
Now, thinking back on it, you know you can't pretend that there wasn't a special meaning to you the day the German major almost killed you before you killed him. Standing over the major with his face blown in by your bullets and the Luger pistol still smoking in his hand, you had tasted an extra flavor of triumph. You had thought, how many has he killed with this same Luger pistol which he'd never use again?
"Seeger, stop grinning down at that body and come on. There's a war on."
"What a shot! What a shot! Right in the middle of the face!"
"Drop that pistol and come on, Seeger. We're falling behind."
"Oh, let him keep it, Olsen. He nicked your helmet with it, didn't he, Norman?"
"Yeah. Twice."
"Oh, then, very fine, but put it away and come on!"
Neither Olsen nor Welch, who were like your brothers, had ever understood why you resolved in that moment there to take the Luger pistol back to America with you and keep it plugged in your desk. You yourself only half understood why, then. Symbol of justice, and you, its instrument. Now, today, with your father's letter and the discussion about the Luger coming so closely together, would it be better to take the pistol back to America? Not as a memento. Not plugged. But loaded? Has America become a strange country to you? You've been away a long time. You don't know what's waiting for you at home. You remember the things you didn't want to remember while you were in the army. The words of hate you overheard. The disgraceful stories that were repeated until finally they reached your ears. Like the story about the aristocratic lieutenant commander who said to the ensign,
"Mister, the Constitution of the United States says I have to serve in the same navy with the Jews, but it doesn't say I have to eat with them."
Or the pretty girl who said,
"And they were so shorthanded, they actually hired a Jewish girl as a secretary. If I weren't so patriotic, I'd resign at once."
The stories, the overheard snatches of conversation, half heard, half twisted, but forever repeated. So many of them, until at last you're forced to realize the German poison has spread. And you determine that maybe it would be better to take that Luger back to America. Not as a memento. Not plugged. But loaded. If there are going to be mobs coming down the street toward your house, you won't go to your death singing and praying. You feel ashamed. Ashamed and ridiculous for these thoughts. This hasn't been the story of America. America's been the land of all peoples, living together in mutual respect. America's been a great
faith in justice and fairness.
Seeger! Seeger, my boy, what are you doing out here in this field? Grazing?
We yelled at you till we lost our voices.
I must have been pretty deep in my father's letter.
Anything wrong?
No, nothing much.
Norman, we've been talking, Olson and me. We decided you're pretty attached to that Luger, and maybe if you...
What Morris is trying to say is we withdraw the request. If you want to sell it, okay. If you don't do it for our sake.
I haven't made up my mind yet.
Anything you decide is perfectly all right with us. Perfectly.
Thanks. No need to say more with these two. As you walk along between them, you remember the time when Olson covered you in the little town outside Cherbourg, when he stood in the middle of a street with no cover at all for more than a minute, trying to return the fire of four Nazi machine guns so that you could get away alive. And there was the night outside of Saint-Lô when Welch and Captain Taney crawled through a minefield in the blackness to bring you in after you'd been wounded. Welch and Olson, tough, dependable, honest. The drinks you've had with them, the long marches, the cold winters, the girls you've gone out with together. What would they think of your father and your brother crouching behind the window in Ohio waiting for the rockets? Olson. Welch.
What is it?
Tell me, what do you fellas think of the Jews?
Jews? What are they? Did you ever hear of the Jews, Welch? No, can't say I have. And remember, I'm an uneducated fella.
Sorry, we can't help you. Ask us another question. Maybe we'll do better.
Welch, what time did you tell that Air Force captain you'd meet him?
8 o'clock, Norman. But we don't have to go. If you have any feeling about that...
We'll meet him. We can use that $65.
Listen, Norman, I know how much you like that gun, and I'll feel like a heel if you sell it.
Forget it, both of you. What could I use it for in America?
You have just heard Act of Faith. This was written by Erwin Shaw and appeared originally in the New Yorker magazine. It was adapted for the Columbia Workshop by Charles S. Monroe of the CBS Program Writing Division. The original musical score was composed and conducted by Alexander Semler. Today's cast included Richard Nelson, Martin Wolfson, Robert Dryden, and Frank Butler. Act of Faith was produced and directed by John Dietz. Next week, the Columbia Workshop will present a radio adaptation of Damon Runyon's story, A Very Honorable Guy. It will be directed by Jack Mosman. Listeners living in or near New York City are advised that for next week's program, the Columbia Workshop will, for that week only, have a studio audience. Those desiring to attend next Saturday's performance of A Very Honorable Guy should write to the Ticket Division, Columbia Broadcasting System, 485 Madison Avenue, New York 22. That's Ticket Division, Columbia Broadcasting System, 485 Madison Avenue, New York 22. Your announcer is Sandy Becker for CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.